Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Frank Wu, professor of law at Howard University and visiting now at the University of Michigan Law School. And we're discussing Bernard Lewis's book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. Frank, glad to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here with you.
Wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a brief sense of what Lewis has to say about the decline of Islam, the status of Islam in the world.
Absolutely. Bernard Lewis is probably the most important Western historian or Western writer of any sort writing on Islam. And he's very distinguished. He's written many, many books. And he wrote a short book that the timing was such that it came out just after the tragic terrorist attacks that so profoundly changed not just our nation but the world. And as he notes at the very beginning of this book, he actually wrote the book well before all that happened. It wasn't written in response. It just happened to be published right afterward, and so it became a bestseller. And he had given a series of lectures. He was asked to give a series of lectures. So this is a very short, very good book, very easy to read. If anyone cares about these issues, I would say they should certainly pick up this book. You don't have to have any particular background as a historian or about Islam. And Lewis really does a thorough and fair job. It's important to emphasize that even though the title is very provocative, you know, the title is What Went Wrong, Western Impact and the Middle Eastern Response, that Lewis is no demagogue. He points out that whenever you ask a question along these lines, what went wrong, there are always two general possibilities. You can look inside or you can look outside. You can ask, is there something we ourselves have done, our institutions, our leaders, the masses? Is there something that's happened that's changed our own society, our culture? And you can also look outside. You can say, who has done this to us? Is it some external enemy? Is it an invader? Is it some influence? And in this instance, is it the United States or the modern world or the West conceived very broadly? You know, it's never quite clear what we mean by the West. You know, sometimes Japan is part of the West. In some sense it is, but certainly not in a geographical sense. And so what Lewis does is he actually sets the stage, probably because he is a historian, very well, very nicely. He goes back quite a ways and talks about the context and explains that there was a time. There was a time, and if you're part of a culture in which memory of history is much better than in our culture, you know, probably even fairly well-educated people can scarcely remember what it was like before compact discs and ATMs and MTV, etc. You know, our historical memory extends back about 15 minutes. But if you're part of a culture that thinks in terms of generations, centuries even, Lewis is talking about time not that long ago, as recently as maybe 300, 400 years ago, when Islam could quite fairly say that it was more advanced than the West, whatever you wanted to look at. You could look at science, you could look at philosophy, you could look at knowledge of the outside world. Does this culture know about other cultures? You could look at whether the army was stronger. And so there was a time when Islam could claim actually to be more tolerant of other faiths, more tolerant, for example, of Jews than Christians were, more open, more welcoming, engaged in more trade. And so that's what's truly tragic here and what makes Lewis's book such a brilliant study. He's not saying it has to be this way. You know, this is not some sort of attack that says that Islam is corrupt or that it dooms people. Rather, he's asking, how is it that a faith, and more than a faith, an entire culture that has such a rich heritage of tolerance, what has happened to it now that it appears to be quite the opposite?
What, briefly, is his explanation?
Well, he looks at a number of possibilities. There are possibilities that people have talked about. For example, resistance to science and to modern notions, treatment of women. Those are just two that many have talked about. But he also talks idea of looking to the outside, accepting other ways. And that's something that, that the West itself has picked up only fairly recently. But that openness, that ability to adapt, being dynamic, is also at the heart of it. And he points out, and I was not fully aware of this, but there's a lot of talk these days about the idea of a civil society, a civic culture, participating in public life. You know, we want to recapture this notion both at the local level, you know, the town, village. We want to build our houses in a certain way to promote the public life, and globally, the global village. And Lewis points out that the idea of a civic culture that's secular, well, that's actually Christian. It comes out of a Christian Western notion of separation of church and state, or separation of faith and state. And that doesn't exist. That does not exist in Islam and in most of the rest of the world. So that, too, is very important.
In general, do you find his account convincing?
I think it is. It is quite convincing. It's convincing, especially because this is not a matter of pointing fingers. It's whenever you write about an entire culture and generalize, it's important to show that you've performed careful study, that you're not just generalizing on the basis of prejudice, but you've looked at the facts and you see the nuances, so that when you make a statement, you know that doesn't refer to every individual, every leader, or even every country. But also important is the tone. And Lewis's conclusion makes absolutely clear. You know, some people may pass by this book, look at the title, and be quite unhappy with it. But the conclusion shows that this is a writer who's sympathetic. This is a writer who, you know, he ends, his last lines are, "For the time being, the choice is their own," meaning that it's up to Islam what it will become. But he's quite hopeful, and he admits he's looking from the outside, but he's quite hopeful that without becoming Western, you know, this is not an attempt to convert Muslims, that Islam can recapture part of its own spirit of openness and help in the path toward peace.
Well, let me ask, though, certainly one issue that is important to address is he ends by saying the choice is theirs, as you pointed out. In so doing, he seems to indicate that there's really not anything that the West has done, or at least very little that the West has done, that perhaps contributes to the animosity toward us and toward some of the internal problems that the Islamic countries may have. Do you agree with that as well? Do you think it is primarily their own failings, closure, treatment of women, views toward science, and so on? Or has the West helped create the problem?
Right, right. I think it would be fair to say that although he focuses on the internal causes, he recognizes there are external ones, and then there's a very complicated, and he doesn't sort this out, he alludes to it. There's a very complicated dynamic. No society now, no matter how much it wishes to be, no society today can be entirely isolated. So there's a complex interaction here, and historically there have been many, many instances, both where the West has attacked in the form of crusades or in other forcible military efforts like that, and he doesn't shy away from pointing that out. And in part, much of the book concerns, well, how did the militaries react? You know, there was a time when if you looked at the West and saw that it had guns and better guns and could be a conquering force, when others would say, well, we want guns too. We want our soldiers to learn to march, to wear uniforms, to have the discipline to do these things that the West has learned to do. And so he does talk about how those have worked together. And I think that also shows how balanced the book is.
Okay, that's very helpful. What I'd like to do, though, is now to ask a little bit about, where do we go from here? I mean, what you've presented in describing Lewis's book is that there is this clash, if you will, between cultures. Some of the things that you mentioned were perhaps some resistance toward science, views toward women, but two in particular that he seemed to emphasize and that you did as well are, one, this issue of openness and tolerance, which many Islamic cultures do not seem to have in the way that either the Western cultures do or that Islamic cultures themselves once had. And so part of the problem, it seems to me, is can that be regained? But the second issue is the question of secularism. Whereas the Islamic cultures once were open and tolerant, much more than Western cultures were, as you described it, the Islamic cultures, with the exception of Turkey, never saw secularism as a real possibility, that there was always going to be a close wedding between religion, politics, and culture in a way that may not be true of the West. Does this mean that these factors will lead to an inevitable clash, a continuing clash between Islam and the West?
I think the answer to that is no. That's Lewis's answer, I would say, and it's certainly my answer. That has been a very popular thesis. You know, it's an old one. There's nothing new to that. It dates back centuries, the idea that there will be an apocalyptic fundamental battle of cultures. It's been revived recently. There's a professor at Harvard, Samuel Huntington, who wrote a book about a decade ago, and he's no crank. He's a brilliant theorist, and he makes the argument that the clash must come, that it is inevitable, and he sees it as actually a three-part struggle. It will involve some combination of Islam, China, and the West, and you know, maybe two against one, or all three, you know, against each other, or whatnot. And so with the terrorist attacks and with everything that's happening now, it's easy to think, well, that's a prophecy come true. But most Americans would recognize a difference, so that even if some parts of Islam don't, so even if there are those who actually do look at this and call it a jihad, what's interesting, and not just interesting, very important, it's a moral distinction. Most Americans, it appears, regardless of their own identity, their own faith, or their partisan politics, most Americans recognize that there's a difference. There's a world of difference between, on the one hand, a war against terrorism, which most Americans support, and on the other hand, a war against a particular racial group or ethnic group or a particular faith. And even though most Americans are supportive of the war against terrorism, there's almost nobody, perhaps a few folks out there who are quite extreme and are recognized as extreme. That's what's important. But there are basically no folks out there who are arguing this is a war in which our goal is to devastate and eliminate a racial group or a faith. And so even if on the other side it's viewed as this clash of faiths, it isn't on the U.S. side. And in fact, the latest study shows that New York City today is one half immigrant, and I would wager a tremendously large number of those immigrants are Middle Eastern, are Arab, and are Muslim. And so you can't have a war of two faiths unless each of those faiths believes that it is such a war.
I want to pursue those themes in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Frank Wu, professor of law at Howard University, and we're discussing Bernard Lewis's book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. This issue about the clash, that you're saying that most Americans don't think of this as being at least an inevitable deadly clash between Islam and the West. But I suspect if you ask most Americans, they would say, but the other side does think that there are substantial elements within Islamic society who do think it's a clash, and indeed a clash to the death. Is that in fact true? I mean, are there substantial elements within Islam who hold that view? And if so, how do we try to deal with this clash, and how do we try to make it so that it is not so detrimental, really, to both sides?
Right. That's That's the hard, hard question. And Lewis only partly addresses that. He does make it clear that though there is not a general belief in a secular civic culture, there's no such thing as being Islamic and secular. While you can be, for example, Jewish and secular, and you can be, and some would argue that the United States is more or less Christian in some sense. You know, a majority of the population is Christian, or at least a plurality, and it was founded with some Christian notions, but it's also secular. And Lewis argues that there's no such thing, maybe Turkey, maybe a few exceptions, but by and large, there's no such thing as being Islamic and a secular civil society. But he notes, nevertheless, that there's tremendous diversity within Islam, just as there is within Christianity. There are fundamentalists, there are moderates, there are mystics, there are people who are reformers who want to modernize, and in many ways there is perhaps a greater plurality of opinion among Muslims than among Christians on many issues. So it would be wrong, for example, to think that Islamic culture as a whole, categorically, without exception, relegates women to a second-class status. That may be in some places, perhaps many places, and now and at some other times, but it is by no means uniform, and the mistake would be to treat it as if it were. So partly, even though we can't control how our adversaries view the world, we can't control how terrorists want to characterize matters, and they may have quite simply a warped view of reality, even though we can't control that, we can certainly control the way that we respond, and then in turn the way that observers, both in the West and in the Islamic world, view matters, so that there is the possibility, and the latest polls aren't all that promising, but there's the possibility that we can show the rest of the world that the United States deserves victory, unquestionably, and that this is a just war, I'm confident that we can do that.
Well, for instance, I just realized two of the things that you said provide, I suppose, at least some grounds for hope, that normally you can't think of Islam as being a wholly separate state. And yet, as you also mentioned, there are a substantial number of people who are Islamic, who live in the United States, many of whom appear to be quite comfortable with the fact that they live in a non-Islamic state while still maintaining their belief in Islam. And so perhaps if that's true in a place like the United States, it could also be true elsewhere. And so there would not need to be quite so tight a wedding between the culture, the politics, and the religion. Or at least it wouldn't have to be inevitable.
Sure, I think that's absolutely true. And it's important also to note that race and ethnicity and faith aren't all the same either. In the popular discussion, and it's why a show such as yours is great, because there's time to reflect and probe more deeply and broadly. In the popular discussion, we tend to confuse things. People speak as if everyone of Arab descent must be Islamic, and all of the people who are Islamic are of Middle Eastern background. And, well, that's just not true. Most of the individuals of Arab descent living in the United States, whether they're citizens or green card holders, most of them actually are non-Muslims. In fact, that makes perfect sense. That's in part why many of these people came here, because they're Christians, because they're more secular, because they've fallen away from the faith of their forefathers, or they're from a dissident faction, or whatnot. So it would be wrong to assume that there's a neat correlation there. And not only that, most of the people in the United States who are Muslim are not of Middle Eastern origin. About a third are of African American or African or black backgrounds, and about a third are Asian. So it's important when we talk about these matters, just to know what the world looks like. And it quite often doesn't look as simple as we might think it looks.
And so part of the problem is that we're inclined to engage in hasty generalization about the connection between ethnicity and between people's religious faiths, about the attitudes of people who are members of religious faiths, and that generalization, that hasty generalization, often gets us in trouble, maybe leads to conflicts where it needn't.
That's right. And what Lewis is showing is that you can be respectful, yet critical. You can show that your criticism, your comments, come from careful study, that they're nuanced, that they don't draw just crude caricatures, and that they're delivered in a way that's a message of hope that is not meant simply to condemn. And here, because there's so much sensitivity with all these matters, it's important to establish both that you have studied the matter and what the tone is. But you know, here's an example. Here's an example of how much detail Lewis goes to. He notes that what is most humiliating now is not only that the Islamic world has fallen behind the United States, but toward the end he talks about who now works as engineers or helping with oil, etc., throughout the region. And it's actually not Westerners in the sense of from the U.S., it is rather people who he calls Westernizers, people who have themselves copied the West, in particular Japan and Korea. So that if you go, if you travel through the Islamic world now, you're as likely to find someone who's Japanese or Korean as you are someone who's a white American helping in the oil fields or giving advice. And he notes, well, as he says, it was bad enough for Muslims to feel weak and poor after centuries of being rich and strong, to lose the leadership that they had come to regard as the right, and to be reduced to the role of followers of the West. But then he notes that the 20th century brought further humiliations, falling ever further back in the lengthening line of eager and more successful Westernizers, notably in East Asia. So he's really thought this through, and thought it through with a great level of detail.
Both you and he then seem to say that what we need to be able to do is we need to be respectful of different cultures, but that doesn't preclude our also being critical of those cultures. However, it's fairly clear that the events in New York and Washington a little over a year ago have perhaps made it more difficult for Westerners to be respectful. I mean, just how much have the terrorist events in the United States made it difficult, more difficult, for us to find a suitable way of living together in the same world?
Mm-hmm. I think actually the terrorism has made it ever more important to heed the message that Lewis offers and to perform the same sort of careful study that he has. Because if our goal is not just to defeat terrorism, but if our goal is also to ensure as best as possible that we prevent terrorism from arising again, because here it's not clear what defeating it would be. There's not a single state that we're going after. It's unlawful combatants. It's much more shadowy. This is not a conventional war. Many people have said that, and I think that's absolutely true. And so the goals are also unconventional. The goal here is not for the United States to conquer another land. The goal for the United States is not to defeat a force that wishes to invade the U.S. and conquer it. The goal here, rather, is to ensure that the scourge of terrorism is, for once and for all, eliminated. And if it can't be eliminated, at least the risk significantly curtailed in the major terrorist operations that are going on now, taken apart and neutralized as best as possible. And so in that more long-term struggle, Lewis's project of asking, how do we make the peace a lasting peace, a genuinely lasting peace? You know, everyone thinks they've procured a lasting peace, but we don't want to be Neville Chamberlain coming back from Berlin in 1939 saying that he has peace for our time. Then the question is, how do we understand the culture to achieve that peace?
All right, let me just ask. We've got about 3 minutes here. I take it from those last remarks that though we might stop or restrain terrorism by purely military means, that Lewis would be skeptical of the claim that we could stop terrorism over the long haul by simply military means. And if that's right, what are the means do we use? What should we be doing? What should we be thinking about other than just winning a military war over terrorism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a terrific question. And that's not to, for a moment, diminish the tremendously valuable, important, absolutely crucial role that will be played by the Army, the Air Force, the Navy. This is a war, and if we do not have the force of arms, we will not be able to prevail. But at the same time, Lewis also points out that much of what is going on here is a deep, deep resentment toward the West, and specifically toward the United States, including from other parts of the West. There are many Western nations that quite deeply resent the United States. For two reasons, really, and here that this is me more than Lewis, I would say one is the U.S. is perceived, rightly or wrongly, I happen to think the U.S. is not nearly as arrogant as others think it is, but I recognize that here perceptions are important, and if others see us as arrogant, as unwilling to consider what others have to offer, including other Western nations, well, then we ought to ask, what can we do to maybe not meet them halfway, but at least meet them, at least go a little bit toward them, and engage in some sort of effort to understand and minimize this sort of conflict. And in addition to that, Lewis points this out, some of the resentment is simply because the United States and the West have far surpassed other cultures in material terms. We have more wealth, and that is deeply galling. The notion that many people own houses, that we drive nice cars, that even a suburbanite who thinks of his or her house as quite modest still has a house two or three times larger and far nicer, and a piece of land that others in most cultures couldn't even dream about. And so part of this has to do with how do we, for our own self-interest as well as because it's right, how do we distribute these goods, what makes life enjoyable, how do we distribute that more fairly so that others do not wish to attack us and take away what we enjoy?
That, of course, is going to be very hard to do, as I think both you and Lewis have indicated. Well, I really appreciate it. We are out of time. It's been great talking to you again.
It's great to be here with you.
I've been speaking today with Frank Wu, professor of law at Howard University. We've been discussing Bernard Lewis's book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.